Okay, good evening, good afternoon to everyone from Elkanah, beautiful downtown Elkanah. Before I begin, I just want to say that this year is going to be in memory of my sister-in-law, Le'ilui Nishmata, Brindel Bat Chaim, Zichra Baruch. Ladies and gentlemen, last week when we met, we took a look at the psukim from the Mikra that dealt with the issues of Shomrim, Pikdonot, and we took a look at the structure of the chapter of the Mishnah and divided it into units for the sake of study. And we're going to be dealing in our meetings with the first unit of the Mishnah, which deals with the issue of how the Shomer Chinam acquires rights over the object that he is watching with regard to the double, quadruple, and quintuple damages that a thief may be obligated to pay if he is found. And we're not going to review everything we did last week because we are short on time as it is, but we're going to take a look just very briefly again to review the Mishnah, and then I want us to go directly into the first sugya and take a look at its structure, and we're going to emphasize the uniqueness of the Shita that we're proposing here, Shita de Rivadim. It's not really new, it comes from the period of the Rishonim, but it gives today, and to the modern learner today, a very quick and easy handle on how to get into the sugya. It's designed from a didactic point of view for those who have less background and need a way to get into the sugya quickly and efficiently with a good overview of where the sugya is going. So let's take a look at the first mission again. You can use the sheets that were distributed to you by email, the sugyot according to Shitat Rivadim, or you can use your Vilna Gemarot if you have them handy. Before we actually begin the Mishnah, I would just like to ask if there are any questions of anyone who participated last week, any questions that you'd like to bring up right now, just very briefly, before we begin. Hearing no questions, we will move on. Take a look at the first Mishnah. Hamafkid etzel chaviro behema o kelim, denignevu o shavdu, שילם ולא רצה להישבע שהרי אמרו שומר חינם נשבע ויוצא נמצא הגנב משלם תשלומי כתר טבח ומחר משלם תשלומי ארבעה וחמישה למי משלם? למי שהפיקדון אצלו. We're going to deal with this section of the Mishnah now, so let's make sure we understand it clearly. That when a person entrusts to his friend either an animal or utensils to guard, and during the course of the guardianship, and this is a guardian who's guarding for free, as a favor for his friend, he's receiving no recompense for it, and during the guardianship the articles are stolen or lost, then the guardian has two choices. He may either pay the owner of the object and thereby take him out of the circle of events, and now it's the guardian who owns the object, so that if the thief is found, he will have the direct relationship with the thief. The owner will not be involved. Because Chazal said, Hare Amru, Shomer Chinam Nishba V'Yotzei, that a Shomer Chinam, if he wishes, can simply take an oath that he had nothing to do with the theft or the loss, and then he's out of the picture. But he may also pay and take the owners out of the picture. And then if the thief will be found, he'll pay double damages. If he slaughters the animal or sells the animal that he stole, then he'll pay possibly quadruple or quintuple damages. And to whom shall he pay? He will pay to the one who guarded the object. Now what has happened here essentially is that the guardian has acquired from the owner rights to the double damages. Now the Torah has said, as we remember from last week, that if a person steals an object and the thief is found and does not admit his theft, then he will pay double damages to the owner. So the double damages is an inherent right as part of property owning, that if your property is stolen, you as the owner of the property have a right to receive double damages from the thief. Now this right is somehow, by some mechanism, being transferred to the guardian when the guardian decides to pay. And of course the question is, how is it possible that this guardian, after all, he has no direct relationship with this object, he's doing a favor for the owner, why does he have the ability to make the decision whether to take an oath or whether to pay, and that will decide whether the owner of the object will or will not be part of the double damage rights if the thief should be found? Why is that the right of the guardian to make such a decision with the property that belongs to someone else? And so our Gemara is going to deal with this question. And what I'd like to explain what we're going to do now is as follows. If you note in the pages that are in front of you that we distributed, you'll see that the Mishnah is on the top and the Gemara is set out after that in numbered lines. I hope you can all see those lines, that the sugya is divided into eight sections with the numbering on the right-hand side of the page from 1 to 8 on the two pages. This indicates that there are eight sections or steps in the sugya, and then we take these major steps and we subdivide them into secondary and tertiary steps within the major numbers. For instance, on the first page, you'll see one aleph and one bet. That means that the first step is divided itself into two secondary steps. Now, we number the sugya, the stages of the sugya like this in order that students will be able to locate exactly what the instructor is talking about quickly without having to look too hard. The instructor will say, we're dealing with component number 2, bet, and everyone's on right on target. Now, the other thing that I want you to notice is that you'll see that there are lines of the text that are hugging the right-hand margin, and there are other lines of the text that are indented to the left. And that is because this sugya is based on the statements of Amoraim. And when we have, that's called an Amoraic sugya, a sugya that's based on the Amoraim. And in that kind of a case, we put the statements of the Amoraim on the right-hand margin, and we indent the later editions of the Stamma de Gemara, the Shakli Vitarya, which is probably the very last Amoraim or the Saburaim, who are commenting on the words of the Amora, explaining the Amoraim, enlarging upon them, deepening our understanding of their intentions. And when we have a sugya like this, according to our method, the first thing that one has to do is scan the sugya. We would have scanned the sugya really in the Vilna edition, and we will have then sorted it into Amoraic components and Shakli Vitarya components. And let's do that now, whether you're using the Vilna or the Rivadim page. Can you please tell me which Amoraim do you see in this sugya, scanning it from beginning to end? Either by the chat window or speak up. Press your transmit button and tell me which Amoraim you see here. Yes, very good. Shmuel says we have Rami Bar Chama, we have Rabbi Zeira, and we have Rava. They appear in a slightly different order. They appear first Rami Bar Chama in component 2 Aleph. Rava appears then in component number 3. And Rabbi Zeira appears in component number 4 Aleph and component number 5. Rava appears again in component number 7 for reasons that we will describe shortly. Now, this order of the Amoraim in the sugya is purposeful. It is not coincidental. It's also not the result of editing of the sugya. The sugya developed, it accumulated very naturally, very organically over the period of the Amoraim. So you see, in Amoraic sugyas, the Amoraim appear in the sugya in order of their generations. So let's identify these three Amoraim and understand what we have here. Rabbi Rami Bar Chama, who appears in component 2 Aleph, was a student of Rav Huna and of Rav Chista in Sura, which was in southern Babylonia. And Rava, who's mentioned in component number 3, is also a student of Rav Chista. He learned together with Rami Bar Chama there in Sura. Rami Bar Chama was somewhat older than Rava, a good number of years older, and they were friends from early childhood all the way through the rest of their lives. They also had a wife in common. Rami Bar Chama married Rav Chista's daughter, and then when Rami Bar Chama died at a relatively young age, Rava then married her afterwards, and they were therefore both married to the daughter of Rav Chista. And they appear in the sugya, usually Rami Bar Chama appears as one who is raising a fundamental definitional question about a halakha mentioned in a Mishnah or a Braita, and Rava usually comes to answer Rami Bar Chama's question. He not only followed him in family life, he followed him in the sugya as well. So we have Rami Bar Chama, and then we have Rava. Following Rava, and Rava was the head of the academy in Mahoza in the fourth generation, and he was a very central figure in Babylonian Amoraic circles. He was probably the first editor of Sugyot, as we know them. And then we come to Rabbi Zeira in component number 4 and component number 5. And Rabbi Zeira was a student of Rava. He was from the 5th generation. There are 3 Rabbi Zeiras in the Talmud, 1st generation, 3rd generation, and 5th, and he's 5th generation. So the Amoraim who appear in our Sugya appear from generations, late generation 3, generation 4, and then generation 5. And therefore, they form a unit unto themselves. As a matter of fact, and this is typical of Amoraic Sugyas in general, if you were to take all of the Shaklavatarya out of the Sugya and just leave the words of the Amoraim, you would have a comprehensible, logical progression from one to the other. And this, when you combine it with the fact that the Amoraim in the Gemara generally speak in the Hebrew language of the Mishnah, whereas the Shaklavatarya is speaking in Aramaic, then you end up with what we would call an early Hebrew Amoraic Sugya, and a later overlay in Aramaic, which conceptualizes, abstracts, and analyzes the statements of the Amoraim. Now, for beginning students of Gemara, this is very, very significant, whether they're high school students or whether they're adults. Because when you look at a Sugya, it's hard to know how to approach it. It looks like a long continuum of text without any organization, when in reality it's superbly well organized and predictable as well. If one knows the names of the basic Amoraim, one can follow it virtually without understanding any content at all. You can map the names of the Amoraim, you can see who they were, when they lived, where they lived, and then you have an x-ray of the Sugya, and you can say, okay, I don't understand the content of this Sugya as of yet, but I certainly can tell you that the Sugya begins with Rami Bar Chama, it moves to Mechoza in the 4th generation and 5th, and it ends in the 5th generation, and that Rava is relating to Rami Bar Chama, and Rabbi Zeira is relating to Rava, and this is the progression of concepts. And now that I have this x-ray, I can then go back and learn the Amoraim, and I know more or less what I'm looking for. I know what they're going to do. And I know that I'm going to be skipping over all of the Aramaic Shaklavatarya, because the Shaklavatarya assumes that you have learned all of the Amoraic Sugya before you touch the Shaklavatarya, in the same way that you need to know a Pasuk before you study Rashi. And therefore, what we're going to do now is learn the statements of these 3 Amoraim, see what the logic is behind their Sugya, and then we're going to go back and take a look at the Stama, the Shaklavatarya, and see what is the Shaklavatarya adding to the Sugya over and above what the Amoraim had to say. Now, overall, I can tell you, in order to shorten the process just a touch, since we only have several lessons together, that Amoraim are basically interested in Psak Halakha. They're interested in exactly what the Halakha is going to be based on the Mishnah or the Braita or the Memra that the Sugya is based on. In our case, a Mishnah. They're interested in Halakha. The Shaklavatarya is not so much interested in the Psak Halakha. It's interested in the logic behind the Psak Halakha, what we call the Svara. And because it gives the svara of the Amoraim, it's likely that for that reason we call those who put the Shaklavatarya together Savoraim, because they deal with svara, with logic, with abstraction and conceptualization. Okay, are there any questions on this so far before we go into the Sugya and learn the Amoraim? No questions? Just press your transmit button and ask, or type it into your chat box. Where have I been all your life, Shmuel? Well, okay, we'll learn. The main thing is, I'm sure all your previous knowledge will help you learn this approach much more quickly. Okay, let's take a look at Rami Bar Chama. Rami Bar Chama says, Matkifla Rami Bar Chama. Rami Bar Chama attacks this Mishnah, and then he says, how can it be that here the owner of the object is transmitting to the guardian the rights to the double damages? There is a general principle in halakha that a person may not give acquisition to another person over something that has not yet come into the world, what we know as futures in the Western commodities market. In Judaism, there is no concept of selling futures. It's considered to be fraud. In any event, the Rami Bar Chama says, our Mishnah is dealing in futures. Because the owner is saying to the guardian, well, here's, watch my animal, watch Betsy very well, and if Betsy is stolen, then and the thief is found, then you're going to get the rights to the double damages if you pay me for her loss. That's giving over to the guardian rights to double damages that don't exist. There is no thief. There is no theft. He hasn't been found. There are no double damages. So how can he gain acquisition on something that is never, that is not in existence yet? So Rami Bar Chama, when he asks this question, he's saying our Mishnah is contrary to accepted halakhic practice. We don't allow people to transfer rights to things that don't exist yet. So how can our Mishnah say that he can? Rami Bar Chama does not answer this question. He rarely answers his own questions in the Gemara. He puts the questions out there in cyberspace and leaving them for Rava to resolve. So let's see what Rava says to him. Rava says, in component number 3, Amar Rava, Na'asa ki omer lo l'cheshati ganev v'tirtse u'tushalmeni hare parati knuya lach me'achshav. Rava introduces a brilliant idea. He says, Rami, he's not transferring any rights before they exist. He's not transferring rights to double damages before double damages exist. Because what he's saying to the guardian is, if in fact Betsy will be stolen, and at that time you decide that you want to pay me, and you pay me for Betsy's loss, then I transfer the rights to Betsy to you retroactively to this moment when the guardianship begins. In other words, what he's saying to him is, I'm not transferring rights to you until Betsy has been stolen, there is a thief, and there are, in principle, double damages to be paid. We just have to put our hand on this thief. And when we put our hands on him, you'll be immediately obligated in double damages. So the double damages really do exist already. But the problem is that because when the thief steals Betsy, and she's no longer in the physical control of the guardian, he cannot take ownership of the animal when she's already gone. So therefore, Rava introduces retroactivity. And he says that the ownership will be retroactive to the beginning of the guardianship, but the retroactivity will only happen once the double damages are in existence in the world. Now, Eitan Diamond from Toronto has just asked, how do we know that lines 2b are not part of Rami's statement, since they are in Hebrew too, aren't they? That's a good question, Eitan. And the answer is as follows. Look at 2b, 2bet. It says, Afilu l'Rabbi Meir de'amar, which means, and even according to Rabbi Meir, who said, and that Dalit, de'amar, is your telltale sign that it's being said by the Shaktivatarya, who is quoting Rabbi Meir. Now, the function of the Shaktivatarya's remark, we're going to see when we study the Shaktivatarya. But that Dalit, de'amar, that is your clear hint that this is Shaktivatarya and not Rami speaking. Not only that, but look at 2 Aleph. Here, my printer made a little mistake. At the second line of 2 Aleph, it says, Veha, Ein Adam Makne Devar Shalom Ba La'olam. The word Veha should also be really in black and not in the color of the Amoraim, because it is not part of the Memra. It's a polishing that was done by the Shaktivatarya. The Memra is in pure Hebrew. Ein Adam Makne Devar Shalom Ba La'olam. So, at this point, we have two steps in the Amoreic Sugya. We have Matkifla Rami Bar Chama, and we have Rava's answer predicated on the concept of retroactivity of ownership from the moment after theft, when the double damages already exist. And with this, he solves Rami Bar Chama's problem, how a person can transfer these rights. Now, after Rava says this, Rabbi Zeira is sitting there in the shir. He hears Rava suggest this as a solution to Rami Bar Chama, and Rabbi Zeira says, wait a minute, Rava, you can't say that. That doesn't work. Because if you say that, then, and I'm now in component number 4 Aleph, says, Ihachi, if that is so, that's probably also a polishing of the Shaktivatarya, Afilu gizoteha uvaldoteha. If you're going to tell me that the ownership is retroactive from the beginning of the guardianship, then during the time that the guardian has had control over the animal, then clearly there's been fleece that's grown on the animal. The animal might have had given birth to babies. And these would then also retroactively belong to the guardian and not to the owner, because once the retroactive ownership takes effect back to the day of the guardianship, then anything that happens after that belongs to the guardian and not to the owner. And how do we know that this is really not the case? Because he says, Lama Tanya, why is it taught in a Braita, Chutz Migizoteo Uvaldoteo, that the transference of the rights to the guardian specifically excludes any fleece or offspring that the animal may bring into the world. And therefore we can see that Rava's concept of retroactivity of ownership from the first day of guardianship doesn't hold water. It doesn't work. It goes against the Braita. And when an Amora goes against the Braita, the Amora loses. There's no contest. So now, what is Rabbi Zeira going to do? Rabbi Zeira cannot leave his Revi Rava in hot water. That he can't do. So he has to make an amendment. He does an amendment to Rava. And he says, Amar Rabbi Zeira, in component number 5, Amar Rabbi Zeira, Na'asaki Omerlo Chutz Migizotea Uvaldotea. Very simple. He says that an amendment like this, that when the owner gives the guardian the animal, and he tells him about this whole process of retroactive ownership from the minute after the theft, he says to him explicitly that this retroactive ownership specifically excludes anything coming from the animal itself, including offspring, fleece, etc. Those things are not included in the deal. The retroactive ownership is only relevant to the double, quadruple, or quintuple damages, but not to anything that comes out of the body of the animal. That's Rabbi Zeira simply adding on a rider onto Rava's legislation. Now, if you look at component number 7 and 8, specifically 7 right now, we have as follows. Ipi de Amre, some people say that Rava said, some people have a different tradition about what Rava said, that he didn't say retroactive ownership from the minute of guardianship, but rather Naasaki Omerlo Lichashati Gane Vitzurtse Utashalameni Samuch Lignevata Kinuyalach. He says to him, well, if Bessie is stolen and you choose to pay me, then the retroactive ownership will take effect back to 1 minute before the theft. Not all the way back to the beginning of the guardianship, but to 1 minute before the theft. And therefore there is no problem the offspring or the fleece of the animal belonging or not belonging to the guardian, because it's been specifically excluded by a retroactivity that's limited to 1 minute before the theft actually takes place. Now, before I ask for questions, I want to point out one other item about the Amoraic Sugya. Not only do you notice that all the Amoraic statements are named, they must be named. There is no such thing in the Talmud as an Amoraic statement that is not named. So you can always identify who's poskening and what's he saying? But in addition to that, they're in Hebrew, which makes things a lot easier, at least at the onset of study. But there's also another very important principle here. You notice that we have 3 Amoraim, but Rava appears twice. Now, why is Rava appearing twice? Because Rava is being brought down in 2 separate formulations. That is, there are individuals that learned Rava one way, and some understood Rava the other. Anyway, now when we have this in the Gemara, that means Rava said one specific statement that was understood in 2 different ways by those who were hearing him. So let's take a look at Rava's statements in its 2 renditions, that is in component number 3 and in component number 7, and let's see if we can discover what was the common kernel behind the 2 renditions of his Memra. In component number 3, Rava said, Na'asaki Omerlo Lechishati Ganev Vitirtse Utashomeni Hare Parati Knuyalach Me'achshav. And in component number 7, what did Rava's reported as having said, Na'asaki Omerlo Lechishati Ganev Vitirtse Utashomeni Samuch Lekinevata Knuyalach. And if you look carefully at that, you'll see that there's a very clear common kernel to these 2 renditions of Rava. And that is, Na'asa ki omerlo lechishatiganev utertze utashomini parati knuyalach, that if you should decide when Bessie is stolen that you're going to pay me, then my cow will be yours. The question is, from when? And some people understood Rava to mean that the cow will belong now to the guardian from the minute of the guardianship. And some people understood that he meant only for a minute before the theft. Zara Mizera belonged to the school that heard Rava to say that it's from the beginning of the guardianship, and so therefore he corrected Rava's statement by saying that it must specifically exclude the fleece and the offspring. Whereas those who brought the second rendition of Rava had a different idea, and they were not in any need of Rabbi Zera's correction, because for them the problem didn't begin, because the retroactive ownership only started a minute before the theft and not from the beginning of the guardianship. And therefore we have a brief three-component Amoreik Sugya in Hebrew that expresses a question on how the Mishnah is working halakhically, an answer in two renditions, and in the first rendition, an amendment offered by one of Rava's students. This is the Amoreik Sugya. That's all there was in the Sugya by the year 500. And then, when the Shakta Vatarya, the owner, the developers of the Shakta Vatarya came to the Sugya, they decided that they wanted to see what they could add onto the Sugya to make it clearer. The Shakta Vatarya was like a shiur being given direct transmission, just like what we're doing now. And the Shakta Vatarya is an Aramaic, which was the common spoken language, because it's like Taich. It's like we translate into English the sources as we teach them. They translate it into Aramaic. Nothing changes over time except details. But the basic principles of human behavior are always the same. So therefore, before we go into the Shakta Vatarya and see what they wanted to do to help us understand the Amoraim better, I'd like to ask you if there are any questions now about the kernel, the Amoraic kernel of this Sugya, before we go into the Shakta Vatarya. Please, press your transmit button and ask, or write your questions in the chat box. No questions? Anyone? Yes. Shmuel asks that I should repeat the kernel one more time. If you note, the kernel in your Rivadim page is component number 2, Aleph. You might want to mark that so that you can see it easily. Component number 3, component number 4, component number 5, and component number 7. Those are the Amoraic sections of the Sukkah that are presented to us in chronological sequence and also logical sequence. That is the Aramaic, the Amoraic kernel of the Sugya. Okay, Shmuel, is that clear now? All right, well, let's move on. We're now going to take a look at the Shakta Vatarya. You meant the common kernel of both Rava's statements. Okay, very good. I'm sorry I didn't understand. Rava basically said that what happens here is that when the animal is stolen, he says to the guardian, if Betsy should be stolen and you decide to pay me, then my cow will become yours. Hare parati knuyalach. My para, my cow will become yours. He didn't stipulate from what time the cow will become his. And so there were among the students two variant understandings of Rava. One is that he meant that the cow would become retroactively his from the guardians, from the moment of guardianship. And the other school held that Rava meant that it will be retroactively his from the minute before the theft. And therefore, two versions of Rava developed based on this common kernel. Okay, now we're going to learn the Shakta Vatarya. Let's take a look at the and Yosef is asking, wouldn't the shearings be part of the sale? Do you mean that wouldn't the shearings be part of the sale if the guardianship was retroactive from the beginning of the guardianship? And the answer to that is yes, they certainly would. That's exactly Rabbi Zera's question against Rava in component number 4. And he says that that can't be true because there's a braita that speaks against that idea. So that could not possibly be the correct understanding of Rava. So what does Rabbi Zera do? Because Rabbi Zera has the opinion that Rava meant from the beginning of the guardianship. So what does he do with the shearings and with the offspring? He says that that must, by definition, not be part of the ownership agreement for transference of rights in case of theft between the owner and the guardian. It's like a footnote that excludes those two items from the transference of rights. Okay, now let's take a look at the stama, at the Shakta Vatarya. We're going to start with two bets, because number one is a piece of Shakta Vatarya that stands on its own, is not connected to the Amorek Sugya. It's a specific argumentation pattern that occurs close to 1,000 times in the Babylonian Talmud, and is taught, we teach it as a pattern. We'll get back to it later. I first want you to see in this lesson, I hope we'll have time to do this, what is the relationship between the statements of the Amoraim and the statements of the Shakta Vatarya. In 2 Bet, the Shakta Vatarya says, Afilu l'ribi neir, de'amar, adam maknedavar, shalo ba'leolam, hani mile kegon pirot dekel, de'avidi de'atu, aval hacha, mi'imar demi ganva, ve'im kintzelo mar demi ganva, mi'imar demi shtekach ganav, ve'im mishtekach ganav, mi'imar demi shalem, dilma modei umiptar. Which, in basic English, is that the Shakta Vatarya says, on Rami Bar Chama's question, that even according to Rabbi Meir the Tana, who held in an argument brought in a Baraita later on in the Perek, where Rabbi Meir says a person can give acquisition to something that has not yet come into the world, even he, the lenient opinion, limits his leniency to things like the fruit of the palm, which is definitely coming. When you have a tree and it produces fruit every year, that's not like something that hasn't come into the world. It's there. You know it's going to happen. It's a predictable crop. It's not like planting something in the ground every year, like wheat or another grain or a vegetable. This is a tree. It exists. Every year it produces fruit without your intervention. And therefore, Rabbi Meir says, in a case like that, where the fruits are obvious, then you can sell your neighbor the fruit of your palm tree next year, because it's obvious that it's going to happen. But in our case of the thief, that's even Rabbi Meir would agree that in this case you can't transfer rights to the double damages, because who says that Bessie is ever going to be stolen? And if Bessie is stolen, who says that Bessie's thief is going to be found? And even if he is found, who says he's going to pay? He has the right to admit his avera and to be exempt from double damages. So it's certainly not similar to the fruit of the palm tree. So therefore, what is the function of the stama here? Yes, when Peter says that this is probably off topic, but it's interesting that the choice of pay or swear is the guardian's and not the original owner. Absolutely right, Peter. It's not only that it's interesting. That is the crux around which the entire sugya is rolling, because it's on that basis that Rami Bar Chama says, what right does he have to be the one to make that decision? Where did he get the rights? Where did he get the ownership to make that decision? And therefore, it's really the essence of the sugya that you picked up. Now, if we go back to what the stama has done, the stama is telling us, on a simple level, Rami Bar Chama says a person is not able to transfer rights that to something that doesn't yet exist. But the Shakta Vatarya knows, because it's 200 years after Rami Bar Chama, that this is not quite so simple. That there's an argument about this, and there were different opinions whether a person can give rights to something that doesn't yet exist. To what extent can a person trade in futures? And therefore, the Shakta Vatarya says, that's all right. Even though there's an argument about this, we will understand Rami Bar Chama according to all opinions. Because Rami Bar Chama is simply saying, even according to Rabbi Meir, who is the lenient opinion on the trading in futures, nevertheless, he limits even his lenient position to something that is not at all like our case. Now, Eitan is asking from Toronto, wouldn't Rami have known about Rabbi Meir? That's an excellent question, really an excellent question. And the answer is that not all the Amoraim knew all of the Braitot. Rabbi Meir's approach does not appear in a Mishnah. If it would have appeared in a Mishnah, he likely would have known it. But he doesn't relate to it, because it could be that he never heard the Braita, and he doesn't know the Shita of Rabbi Meir. Could be that they never ran into it. And even if he did run into it, it could be that he's understanding the way the Shakla and Tarya is explaining, that he's saying, no, even according to Rabbi Meir, it's not relevant to the argument, because even if the there is, even according to this argument, both opinions in the argument would agree that the thief is not like the fruit of the palm, and therefore the whole Tannaitic argument is irrelevant. I think so. Whether we say that Rami Bar Chama was aware of Rabbi Meir or not aware of Rabbi Meir, it doesn't matter. The Shakta Vitaya is trying to deepen our understanding of the Amora by pulling the curtain back behind his logic and saying, look what Rabbi Bar Chama was thinking before he spoke. He was thinking, well, does this go according to this Tana or that Tana, or this logic or that logic? It's like asking a student in a classroom, explain Rami Bar Chama to me. Why does Rami Bar Chama say this? What's his logic? And then the answer is going to be what the Shakta Vitaria says here. Okay? Does everyone understand what the relationship is between the statement of Rami and what the Shakta added onto him 200 years later? Now, it's important for you to understand that when the Shakta Vitaria adds something onto the words of an Amora, then really, this is a supposition. It's a speculation. We don't know that that's what was in the Amora's mind. But that's okay, because the Stama de Gemara, the Shakta Vitaria, isn't so interested, really, in what was in the Amora's mind or not, because what it's trying to say is, what would the Amora have said if he was here with us talking according to the terms and the conditions that we're talking about now? What existed in his time is what he said. But what would he say if he was with us here in the Beis Medrash and we're raising this question of the machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim? How would he respond? And he would respond by saying, don't bring me Rabbi Meir. I don't care about Rabbi Meir. Even Rabbi Meir would agree with my question. And so the Shakta Vitaria is really giving us a speculative explanation of Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Bar Chama, at a much deeper level than we understood previously. So therefore, I like to say that Shakta Vitaria is Gemara for the advanced. Amoreksa gives us Gemara for beginners. And therefore, whenever we teach Gemara to beginners in high schools or in junior high schools, the first thing we do is we teach students, or adults for that matter, it's really the same process. We try and teach students, first of all, how to learn Amoreksa. That's number one. Understand who the Amoraim were, where they come from, what do they do here, what are they adding on top of the Tanaim. And after the students have experienced that in 10, 15 sugyas, and they understand how the sugya works, then we say, okay, now let's go to the advanced stage. Let's take a look at the Stama de Gemara. What is the Shakta Vitaria adding onto these Amoraim? What is their conceptualization? What is their abstraction? What is their generalization? And that way the students are being ratcheted up to a higher level of thinking after they've mastered the basic material on which that thinking is based. Okay, now the problem we have today in schools and in yeshivas, in the entire yeshiva world to which I belong, is that we learn the text of the Gemara in most yeshivas consecutively in linear order as if the whole text was written at the same time. This is simply false. It's just false. It's ignorance. The text was not written at the same time. The Amoraim were written first and the Shakta Vitaria was written afterwards. And therefore, I have spoken to many Gedolim who told me that anyone who learns the Gemara without distinguishing between Amoraim and the Shakta Vitaria is simply untrained. He doesn't know what he's doing in the sugya. And it's important to teach people methodology. Now, we have two more comments here on the chat that I'd like to relate to. The first is, Gary is saying, is it really advanced or just the next layer down? In some sense, the early stage is the more central discussion. Yes, I would, and then Gary adds again, the later edition is the next, and in some sense, less important area of analysis, no? Now this, in order to answer this question, it's an important question that you're asking, Gary, and I think that the answer to it is based on why do we have Shakta Vitaria in the first place. And I'll try to summarize this in the 5 minutes that are left. And we'll go back to the Stama de Gemara in next lesson, but this is a very important point that Gary brings up, and I want to answer it. The reason why the Amoraic period ends in about the year 500 and the Shakta Vitaria begins at that time is because in the year 500 we have the passing of the last Amoraim who had a relationship of smicha to the Sanhedrin, which was closed in the year 425. Amoraim worked by definition in concrete questions of halakha lemaaseh, psak halakha. They were not interested in conceptualization so much because they saw every case individually, the way the case law works. But after the Amoraim were gone, and those who came later saw themselves as not having the authority to work on a case-by-case basis, they attempted to change the case law of the Amoraim into statutory law, conceptual abstract law that could be taken, would be what we call vested and portable. It could go anywhere, in any circumstance, and be applied. And therefore, the Savoraim are talking in abstract conceptual terms because that's what they require in order to keep the halakha applicable in new circumstances and in new places. Now, whether you want to consider that a decline from the Amoraic state or an increase in sophistication, I suppose depends on your perspective. But today in the yeshivas, when they talk about Gemara, they're specifically talking about Shakta Vitarya. Most Bachurei Yeshiva, even those who study in the Yeshiva Tichonit for 6 years, at the end of the 6 years, if you ask them in this sugya, what are the Amoraim saying, what did the Shakta Vitarya add on top of it, they'll look at it like you fell from Mars. They won't have a clue what you're talking about, because even their teachers don't know the difference between the Shakta Vitarya and the Amoraim. And this is because the Masorah, about the way we're supposed to learn, has been set aside in the last two generations as people began learning en masse from printed books instead of from the original Masorah that comes down from the Rishonim. And the purpose of our method, Shitata Rivadim, is to reinstate the original method of the Rishonim, the way you learn a sugya, by training people first about Amoraim, about Memras, about Amoraic sugyas, and only after that, about the Shakta Vitarya as an added layer. That's what we call it the layer system, the Rivadim system, an additional layer on top of the Amoraim. Now, it's much more complicated than I make it sound. Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you. Just to follow up this question and your answer to it, would then the Savoraim see themselves, in how you've explained this, would they not see themselves as being of lesser importance or of lesser authority because they were no longer under the process of Smicha the Sanhedrin, and therefore would they not themselves have seen Shakta Vitarya as being a...
Gary, you're cutting in and out. I didn't hear the last...
A lesser step, a step of explanation, this is, but a lesser step than the Amoraic step.
Okay, I understand what you're saying.
Hear you.
Let me just try to flesh it out a little bit more. So, let me just try to flesh out my answer a little bit more and relate to what you said. There's no doubt in the world that the Savoraim saw themselves as being on a lesser level than, a lower level than the Amoraim, just as the Amoraim saw themselves as being on a lower level than the Tanaim, and in the same way that we see ourselves as being on a lower level than the Rishonim and the Achronim. And, however, we have a principle in halakha that halakha kibatra, that halakha is always like the later authority, because the later authority is the one who is contemporary with the circumstances for which he is poskening. And only the later authority understands how the earlier principles and earlier piskei din can be applied in the new circumstances of his day. And therefore, his authority is tantamount to control over the halakhic system, and in that way, he really has control over the interpretation of all who came before him. Because what he's saying is, he's not trying to change what the Amoraim said. He's saying, if the Amoraim were alive with me today, in my period, with my conditions, this is what they would say. And because he's trying to get to the heart of their logic, the way that that they would say it in changing circumstances. And in that sense, you can see that Savoraim really is as a very brilliant addition onto the Amoraic industry, because they're trying to condense the Amoraim into concepts, abstractions that can be applied everywhere. And if they wouldn't have done that, we would not have halakha today the way we have it. But when we're dealing with students, for instance, in a high school, and whether they're students coming from a dati background or a non-dati background, it's a question of children or beginners in the adult world training themselves to how to read the text correctly, and not just to assume that you open it up and read it like a Western book, one line at a time, from top to bottom. That's just, it's just a travesty to do that to the Gemara. And as you can see, when you use this method, the Rivadi method, you're turning the Gemara into a three- or four-dimensional system where you can actually see the dynamics of the discussion and the evolution of the halakha under very different circumstances. So, in our last 2 minutes, are there any other questions that anyone would like to ask or write in the chat box for me to relate to?
Thank you.
Anybody can try out their system. If they haven't spoken yet, do you have any questions?
Okay, if there are no questions, then from beautiful downtown Elkanah in the Jewish Shomron, I will bid you all adieu, and you should have a happy Lag BaOmer. Be careful of the bonfires, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday with Belzon. All the very best to everyone.